Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Reza Zadeh, assalamu alaikum to you, and welcome to your show, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
So, in this new series of the program, The Teacher, we are concerned with some of the outstanding and prominent Muslim thinkers and scholars. And for this episode and the upcoming ones, we have selected Muhammad Iqbal, who was a famous poet, scholar, and politician of India, now present Pakistan, and in fact, whose poetry and some of his works in politics were really outstanding, and his vision, in fact, of the independent states of the Muslims for British India was to inspire the creation of Pakistan at that time. And he's commonly referred to as Allama Iqbal, a polymath or a scholar. So for today's discussion, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh, we want to get to Iqbal's poetic works, which are primarily written in Persian language rather than Urdu. And this is very interesting because he was an Urdu-speaking man, but most of his poetry were produced in Farsi or in Persian language. He has about 12,000 verses of poetry, but 7,000 verses were written in Persian language, and he published them in different formats and in different titles of the books. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's get to you first, brother, for the works that have been produced by a Pakistani in Farsi language. You yourself, as a person from the country Pakistan, what do you think the main reason for Iqbal was in order to choose the Farsi language to, and not his mother tongue, Urdu?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Talking about the time in which Iqbal was living, obviously the Persian language was the official language at that time. Mm-hmm. In the subcontinent, in the Turkish area and the Iran, obviously it was the greater Iran at that time.
Okay.
And later when the East India Company, they came and they did the separation and they overruled the governments and all those things, they started to change the things around. But obviously, at that time, if we look at the history, we can see most of the scholars at that time, even their books were written in Persian. Hmm. For example, if we look at the old Hausa books that were written by the, for example, the Sunni Hausa scholars or the Shia,
yes,
the most of the books were written in the Persian and Arabic. Mm-hmm. So the Urdu, yes, they used to speak Urdu, okay, they used to talk, but yes, Urdu, because it wasn't the official language, mm-hmm, that's why people were not going after
this. He selected Farsi Dari.
Yes.
In fact, as
obviously, at that time, yes, it was the same Farsi, yes, not this one that we have,
okay,
right now.
Okay.
On top of that, obviously, Persian language, we know that, is vaster than Urdu.
Yes.
The vastest language in the world is Arabic, mm-hmm, which has many words in different meanings, yes, and for one thing, they have many, yes, words.
The linguistic system is really complicated, that's right.
After that, the, okay, second language that we can count is the Persian language.
Persian, Farsi, that's
so
right.
Iqbal also says, like, in order to express my feelings, mm-hmm, you know, I think I remember when we were talking about Allama Tabatabai,
yes,
his poetry,
yes,
we said, like, he said, in order to express my thinking,
yes,
and the thoughts that I, yes, have, the only way which I found was poetry. Mm-hmm. So Iqbal has done the same thing because he was the philosopher as well.
Yes.
On top of that, the language which he chose was the language which he knew and who could, obviously, the language that could express,
that's
his,
right,
feelings, mm-hmm, in the best way.
That's all right.
Because there's still limitations in Urdu. In Urdu, we use the Persian and, mm-hmm, Turkish, okay, words.
Okay.
Even the English words are in Urdu language.
Okay.
You know that the Urdu language is,
yes,
the language of camp.
Camp.
There was,
okay,
a tent.
Yes.
Urdu. In Persian, Urdu,
okay,
is said to the camp or,
yes,
tent.
Yes.
Basically, the British army, they gathered the Turks, the Persians, the Indians,
yes,
Sanskrit,
yes,
who used to talk,
yes,
and Britishers, they were,
that's
there.
Right.
They had this army, like, in the World War, mm-hmm, and around that.
Yes.
In that camp, we can say, the army camp, this language was created.
Created, that's right.
With the name of Urdu.
And
it was
this
a common
Urdu and camp, when,
yes,
it is, when it is, you know, we listen to some of our experts who are originally here speaking Urdu language, you can find different words, Arabic,
yes,
Persian, we can say English. So many we can say English words are over there. So this was the main reason.
This was the main
in
reason.
In order, yes, to express his feelings. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sayyid Mohsen, we'll get, of course, to the Urdu poetry of Iqbal, and you are the expert in this field. I know you can read out some of his Urdu language poets. Say, Dr. Reza Sadeh, here and there, Iqbal says that I was very much influenced by Rumi or Maulavi and Maulana. And the approach also that he selected in order to express his feelings is very much the same as Maulana or Maulavi, known in the West as Rumi. Because he says that in order to express my feelings regarding Islam, regarding, we can say, the knowledge of Allah, the knowledge of yourself, and the messages that he had for the Muslim land and the Eastern people, mm-hmm. We can say these are the main content that also could be found in the works of Maulana Maulavi too.
Right.
What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, we can say that the Persian poetry, according to what some of the experts of the Persian poetry say, the Persian poetry, this very rich treasure that, alhamdulillah, we have, mm-hmm. You know, has had many different stages in the history. But two times in the history, it has had very serious, let's say, reformation or, say, evolution.
Okay.
And the first one was in the 5th century of the Islamic calendar, by people like Sana'i and Nasir Khosrow, because what they did, I mean, I'm talking content-wise.
You are talking about the content, that's
yes,
why. Okay.
That's important.
Not the masterpieces.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, what these two people did, and they had great influence on the poets that came after
upcoming
them.
Upcoming generations.
Was that, yeah, the upcoming generations yes. of the poets, was that they brought some of the, let's say, philosophy and philosophical thoughts right. into the Persian poetry. Mm-hmm. And that was really a very huge, let's say,
influence
and
right.
Evolution. And then, because before that, usually most of the poetry was really about earthly things, mm-hmm. you know, that they were good for the kings and, you know,
yeah.
the joys and the,
of
this
the
world.
And the joys,
this world,
right.
and, yeah. And then with the coming of some poets like Rumi, mm-hmm. that you mentioned yes. in your question,
Maulavi
and some,
also?
And then,
okay.
Yes. Yeah, and then also people like Hafez, poets mm-hmm. like Hafez,
okay.
you know, this comes to its really peak of the beauty mm-hmm. When they bring these mystical, philosophical, religious thoughts into the Persian poetry.
Right.
And then the second evolution or reformation of the Persian poetry, you can say it happened in the contemporary time, mm-hmm. mainly by the works of Iqbal.
Okay.
You know, this shows how influential he
yes,
has
brother.
Been.
Yes.
Although he has not been a Persian-speaking person,
mm-hmm.
but his poetry was so rich, especially in the content and also in the style,
that's right.
that we can say that he is one of the reformists of the Persian poetry
mm-hmm.
because he brought a completely different genre
mm-hmm.
into the Persian poetry that we can say it was unprecedented before him.
That's all right.
And that is a type of poetry that invites people mm-hmm. To come back to their original roots, a type of revolutionary thought, political thought into the Persian poetry. And a lot of us. So I can mention the major themes
Definitely.
That we can find in the works of Iqbal.
Right.
But going back to your
yes.
question,
yes.
when you say that he was influenced by Rumi, it was from some special aspects.
Yes.
Yeah, undoubtedly when it comes to the beautiful mystical poetry,
yes.
Rumi is one of the greatest examples.
Yes.
So he has influenced any other poet that has come after him.
Right.
And Iqbal, as one of the aspects of his poetry was mystical and let's say
looking
love
for
poetry.
Metaphysical, that's
yeah,
right.
he
okay.
really was influenced from Rumi from that aspect only,
okay.
but not from other
that's
aspects.
Right. Okay,
because the poetry of mm-hmm. Iqbal was somehow more let's say multidimensional.
That's all right.
He has dimensions in
yeah.
his poetry that we cannot find, for example, in the poetry of Rumi.
Yeah, and very much more concerned with the societal and sociocultural aspect
yeah.
of the area in which he was living. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, states, "We have a large number of non-Persian-speaking poets in the history of our literature, but for sure I cannot point out any of them whose poetry possessed the qualities of Iqbal's Persian poetry." Another part, Ayatollah Khamenei says that he never lived in the cradle of Persian culture, never have direct association with it. He cast with great mastery of the most delicate, the most subtle, and radically new
right.
philosophical themes into the mold of Persian poetry, some of which are unsurpassable yet.
Yes.
And this is what Ayatollah Khamenei said about the
Iqbal. And look what he says himself. Mm-hmm. He says, پس از من شعر من خوانند و دور یابند و میگویند جهانی را دگرگون کرد یک مرد خداگاهی. After me, people will recite my poetry and they will find jewels.
That's right.
And they will say, a man, a self-conscious man, changed the world.
That's
you know?
Right. Yeah.
He said, they will find the beauty of my thoughts and my influence in
That's
my poetry. In that, and that is really true.
Okay.
Let me
we will get one
Urdu poem.
Okay, we'll get...
It's about him, because we just mentioned about Rumi and Sanai. He's introducing himself, obviously.
Uh-huh.
That's what...
Now, do you want to read it in Urdu for us? Very good.
In Urdu, he says, like, Firdos mein Rumi se ye kehta tha Sanai. Mashriq mein abhi tak hai wahi. کاسہ و وہی آش حلاج کی لیکن یہ روایت ہے کہ آخر ایک مرد قلندر نے کیا راز خودی فاش. He says like in the Firdos, in the heavens,
That's right.
Rumi and Sanai, they both are talking to each other and they're saying like in the east it's the same situation. Hamun kase hamun ash.
Ash, that's right. The same bowl, the same soup
is used in the Persian language.
Okay.
So he brought this term from the Persian language.
Okay.
And then he says, Hallaj, he came up with the new narration, and he came to them and he told them a new news, and he said that there is a new man who raised in the east, who has taken out the secret of the khudi. Khudi is obviously self, the secret of self.
Self knowledge.
So
self,
he
right.
has basically unveiled this secret now, and people will inshallah go towards the. Perfection.
Okay.
So he has in both languages. Obviously, he has
both languages. He's very much emphasized on the role that he himself had, and we know that in Iran he was very much welcomed, and we can say he has influenced very much the thoughts and the works of the outstanding scholars and thinkers throughout his poetry. What is really interesting about Iqbal's poetry is producing these works in Persian language. We do not have time. For this episode, we will inshallah get to some of his outstanding works in our upcoming sessions of the program. It was very kind of you, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Rezazadeh. And dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the program, The Teacher on Allama Muhammad Iqbal Lahori. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Dr. Rezazadeh recited some of his masterpieces in both Persian and Urdu languages and translated them into English. We will get, of course, to the collections of Iqbal in both Urdu with the titles in our upcoming session of the program. You can also visit our website for more information on his personality, parstudio.com/Ian Kalav Islam page, or say YouTube page, Kalav Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community, and that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them He chose us. And He chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana, adhaqahu Allahu ba'sa al-hadid." If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he's going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. So we have to be very clever, very intelligent to understand what to say, to whom to say, when to say, how to say. You cannot say everything to everyone at every moment. This is not working. Unfortunately, we see only, most of the time, I'm not saying 100%, only one type of words and a speech and a statement and presentation coming, no matter it is a Shia or is a non-Shia, is a Muslim, non-Muslim. Everything that we say to everyone in the same way. We don't have that much of sophistication to have different products nicely prepared, packed, presented to different types of people. Some people have some problems. They cannot take this product. We should give them another product. But we say, no. We do one type of, you know, commemoration for Imam Hussein. Whether you like it or not, this is your problem. But then sometimes people come and see, and they don't like, because they are not prepared for this. Sometimes I have heard people who were thinking of becoming a Shia. They were in the process of research. But when they attended some of the majalis of Azadari, they said, this is not my way of, you know, life. This is not going to work for me. This is good for you. Because we have made it so much cultural that a person new to the school of Ahlul Bayt would not understand. Even people inside the community sometimes don't understand and don't appreciate. So we have to be very careful.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A few years ago, I made this suggestion, and I repeat here, maybe inshallah some people listen, alhamdulillah, after that suggestion something good came. So maybe inshallah again something good can come. My humble request is that our community in any part of the world, we should dedicate one night of Muharram or before Muharram to educating non-Shia and non-Muslim about Imam Hussein. Because if you look at our normal majalis, it's good for us. Alhamdulillah, we are thankful to Allah. But it's not planned in the way that you can invite someone or bring your colleague or your neighbor to the majalis and say, okay, come and learn. Because for many reasons. One is that because in every night we address a little of bit of the tragedy. Also, we do many other things that they don't understand. If before Muharram comes, we invite our neighbors and say, you know, we are soon going to commemorate the event of Karbala. So we would be very honored if you could join us in this weekend to our center, for example. We want to have a little presentation about what happened in that point in history and why we are commemorating. So when they receive this letter, the letter by itself is helpful. Even if 10% come each year, gradually after 10 years, you have educated the whole neighborhood. A little film, video clips, a very nice 20 minutes presentation, some refreshment, question and answer if they like. In this way, we can educate people about Imam Hussein. But if we just, you know, show what we are doing for ourselves to them, maybe they don't understand. And maybe even they don't appreciate because they don't have the background, they don't have the clue. So my suggestion is to plan, inshallah, in the way that at least one night, one day, at least 10% of our energy and resource goes to educating other people also about Imam Hussein. If we don't introduce Imam Hussein, who is going to introduce Imam Hussein? Do you expect other people to come and introduce Imam Hussein to the English people? We have to do this. I think we haven't done enough. And I feel very sad and embarrassed that even today when we want to introduce Imam Hussein, we say that this is, you know, what Gandhi said about Imam Hussein. This is what, you know, for example, Nelson Mandela said about Imam Hussein. I'm not saying this is bad. Yes, at this stage, maybe we don't have any other choice. But this is really embarrassing. It must be quite opposite. All the leaders of the world, all the people who are well-known celebrities, they must have known Imam Hussein and they must refer to Imam Hussein. Not that today I need to prove Imam Hussein by referring to these people. Isn't this a shame for us that people know more about Mother Teresa than they know about Lady Zainab? It's a shame. Not because I'm against Mother Teresa, I respect Mother Teresa, but I say it's a shame for us that people know about her more than they know about Lady Zainab. If they had known about the values of Lady Zainab, how then even some Muslims could think of attacking the shrine of Lady Zainab? Isn't it because we were not also doing good enough to introduce the lady? The hatred is there, the ignorance is there, but I say we have to also blame ourselves. We cannot put all the responsibility on the others. We have not also done enough to show the beauties, the values, the qualities that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam had. So Amirul Mu'mineen said, "Man adha'a sirrana adha'ahu Allahu ba's al-hadid."
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe as hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day. Even though we've strayed from him and his way, my brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way, Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back from London. Plenty to cover in this half hour, but we will begin in West Africa. Three French soldiers have been killed in the West African nation of Mali after their armored vehicle hit an improvised explosive device. The soldiers on a mission in the southern region of Hombori were part of France's military operations in Mali, fighting against rising numbers of Takfiri militants. Large parts of Mali are still outside the government's control. The fight against insurgents has left thousands of people dead following a 2013 political coup. The French government has come under increasing scrutiny over its role in the destabilization of Mali and after its soldiers were accused of killing innocent civilians in the country. France has more than 5,000 troops deployed in West Africa. Let's cross over to the French capital, Paris, and speak with author and filmmaker Kristen Hahn. Good to have you with us. So how is France involved in the atrocities of the Malian civil war?
Well, France, after the fallout of the Libyan civil war in 2013, they initiated an operation called Serval Operation, which allowed them to control again on the north of Mali with the central Mali government. This operation had a rather popular support in the Mali population, but after that, France started the operation called Barkhane Operation, and they installed like 5,000 troops in Mali. Today, these troops are highly criticized by an increasing number of the Mali population because they do not understand why France is still physically present in the Mali territories. Now, right, we have to admit that the France troops are very extremely careful not to commit crimes against the Mali population because they know they will be harshly criticized if they do so. Now, an important watchdog in France with the name Survie, they say that the real reason of the French military presence in Mali is not the fight against terrorism, but the defense of its important economic interests inside Mali, but also at the border in Niger, where the main uranium mines are only 200 kilometers from the Mali border.
Right, and apart from the French troops there, there's the 14,000 UN Blue Helmets, there's the G5 troops also. There was a peace agreement in 2015. Why are we looking at all this violence still?
Well, it must be considered as the what they call France-Afrique, which is, Mali, as other countries became independent beginning of the 60s, 1960 was the official independence of Mali, but it was immediately replaced by an authoritarian regime, totally submitted and controlled by French powers, French government. The control on raw materials is extremely important for France because the main energy in France is produced by electricity, which is produced by nuclear power plants, and these nuclear power plants need an important part of uranium. Niger has the fifth reserve of uranium mines in the world. Mali itself has uranium mines, but not exploited yet, and also has other raw materials. So this is really about economic interest. It's a neo-colonial interest that France has in France-Afrique, and especially in Mali. So all the presence of these troops, it can be UN troops, it can be other troops, but they are dominated by the ancient colonial power, France.
Just to not to belabor the point, but are we to conclude that the French involvement within the region has been more of a destabilizing factor than anything else?
Well, it's certainly not improving the situation. Currently, they're in huge parts of the territory in Mali. There are no public services anymore, in particular schools. There is an internal displacement of 260,000 persons, which creates a critical humanitarian situation. And also the power is concentrated in the hands of only a few persons who are submitted to the former colony. So if there was an important support of the Mali population when the north of Mali was under control after the Tuareg rebellion, was controlled by radical Islamist groups like Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, that kind of operation had the support in Mali. But currently, if France is linked with the government of Mali that is not doing any social improvement on the ground, it will be criticized more and more.
Right. More has to be done to for investment in development rather than seeking a military solution to a conflict that's dragged on for so many years. Kristen Hahn in Paris. Chris, thank you. Moving on now, the sentencing by a Saudi Arabian court of prominent Saudi women's rights activist Loujain Al-Hathloul has sparked a torrent of international criticism. On Monday, the court handed Ms. Hathloul a nearly six-year prison sentence on terrorism-related charges after she and groups of other Saudi women campaigned for the lifting of a ban on female driving in 2018. The sentencing was followed by urgent calls for the activists' release from multiple countries and international bodies such as France, the incoming U.S. government, and the UN Human Rights Office. The race to vaccinate 450 million people across the European Union against COVID-19 has begun, and some would say not a moment too soon. The vaccine's delayed arrival has caused frustration across the continent, especially with the emergence of a new variant of the virus, and Italy has accused Germany of getting 10 times the number of doses delivered to Rome. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across Europe began this weekend. Healthcare workers and the elderly are getting the jab first. EU leaders have negotiated contracts for more than 2 billion vaccine doses from various suppliers. The first 200 million are the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine.
It was important for me to get vaccinated in order to protect myself, to protect my family, and to be a part of the solution to stop the pandemic.
I felt honored to get the vaccine, and lucky, because I can finally feel more protected. What gives me relief is the prospect that, after such a difficult and challenging period, we will finally get to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The EU had planned the rollout to begin in unison across the bloc Sunday, but Hungary, Germany and Slovakia couldn't wait and began vaccinating on Saturday. The Netherlands says it won't start vaccinating until January 8th. The start of the EU's vaccine rollout comes after a more infectious COVID-19 variant was detected in the UK, which led to dozens of countries closing their borders to UK citizens.
Only if countries are looking and testing effectively, will you be able to pick up variants and adjust strategies to cope? We must ensure that countries are not punished for transparently sharing new scientific findings.
The new variant has been detected in several EU countries as well. But vaccine developers say they expect their shots to work against COVID-19 mutations. More than 600,000 vulnerable people have already been vaccinated in the UK, which started administering the Pfizer jab 2.5 weeks ago. But ministers warn the country must double its vaccination target to 2 million a week in order to avoid a third wave.
I think it's an incredibly serious, incredibly dangerous moment. I think all of us always felt that January was going to become very hard and that we were heading into a very hard winter, and hospital leave was being cancelled and ITUs were being got ready. And yet, nevertheless, I feel like we weren't ready for something quite as severe as this feels, with the sheer level of caseload and the added effect of the variant virus building up our R number and making things so much harder than we expected.
The UK hopes to expand its vaccination program with the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which is expected on January 4th. There are now more COVID-19 patients in hospitals in England than there were during the peak of the first wave, and more than 71,000 Britons have died of the virus. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia's prison service has called an opposition figure, Alexei Navalny, to return from Germany and abide by the terms of a suspended prison sentence he received 5 years ago, or face the possibility of a real jail sentence. 44-year-old Navalny was airlifted to Berlin in August after he collapsed during a domestic Russian flight. His aides claimed he had been poisoned. Navalny was discharged from hospital on September 20th and is now required to observe the terms of his sentence. Germany accused Moscow of attempting to kill the Russian opposition figure with a military-grade poison, but have provided no evidence. Western governments have used the episode to attack Russia with accusations and sanctions. Moscow has denied any involvement. A magnitude 6.3 earthquake has jolted central Croatia, causing considerable damage to homes and other buildings southeast of the capital, Zagreb. A similar quake with several aftershocks hit the same region Monday. The military has been deployed to help with the rescue operation. The quake is believed to have killed at least one person, a girl, and injured many more. The powerful quake was felt in neighboring Serbia and Bosnia, and even as far away as the southern Austria. We'll, of course, keep you posted on the latest updates as and when we get them. EU ambassadors have given unanimous approval to the Brexit trade deal with the UK. Germany, which currently holds the EU presidency, confirmed the decision after a meeting in Brussels to assess the Christmas Eve agreement. The deal still needs approval from the EU's legislature, expected in February. The UK's House of Commons is expected to approve the deal Wednesday. The agreement provisionally allows tariff-free trade with Britain, valued at over £660 billion, and generates hundreds of thousands of jobs throughout the continent. Following the death of countless black people at the hands of white militia and the police, in this edition of Cut to the Chase, Richard Sedan looks at U.S. law enforcement and asks if the spread of white supremacy in the police force explains why those guilty of murder get away with it.
Millions of people around the world have been discussing racism in America, which more and more has simply become known as white supremacy. White supremacy, the ideology by which the US was founded on, remains visible in all areas of life. To be clear, racism or white supremacy is an ideology and a system of power. It doesn't mean white people. In fact, there are many non-white people who help to uphold the global system of white supremacy. Many, including some in the media, have drawn attention to white supremacist individuals, groups, and even presidents, which is a good thing, you might say. But one thing the mainstream media have been virtually silent on are serious concerns about the presence of white supremacy in US law enforcement. And where do these concerns come from? Well, how about from law enforcement itself? In 2006, the FBI published a report in which it raised concerns over
efforts by individuals, particularly amongst those already within law enforcement ranks, to volunteer their professional resources to white supremacist causes with which they sympathize.
Put simply, even the FBI are concerned that the police and criminal justice system is rife with white supremacists and is a culture in which the dangerous ideology is allowed to exist and grow. When we think about this, we should think about the fact that police officers almost never get charged for murder. We should think about the dozens of suspected lynchings in the US, all being ruled as suicides. And why is it that whenever there is an investigation, it seems doomed to fail? Many point to the case of Ahmaud Arbery as an example of suspected white supremacism in the police force, leading to a culture in which Arbery was seen as a target, and importantly, a culture which saw the McMichaels and Roddy Bryan almost not even arrested at all. In fact, after Travis McMichael had killed Arbery, he blamed Arbery, while the police sympathized with McMichael. Is there a relationship between white supremacy within the law enforcement and law enforcement not investigating white supremacy? In addition to the growing concerns of white supremacism extremism within law enforcement, in 2017, the FBI and Homeland Security published yet another report showing that white supremacists had carried out more attacks than any other domestic extremists over the previous 16 years. Former FBI agents like Mike German have continually highlighted the problem. In 2020, 14 years on from the FBI's own warnings in 2006, an FBI director, Christopher Wray, told US lawmakers that white supremacist extremism now made up the majority of the FBI's domestic terrorism cases.
And I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacy.
There have been many reports highlighting the problem of white supremacy within law enforcement, even by within law enforcement itself, and the fact that nationwide white terrorism is growing. As to why it still exists in law enforcement, why it's not investigated, and why the media barely highlights it, in fact, this year even saw the notorious white supremacist Boogaloo Boys accused of trying to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. And we have even seen white supremacist groups openly carry guns, breaking gun laws in front of the police. And an outgoing president who, rather than condemn such groups, told them to stand down. All of this makes a dangerous reality in the United States. Given that the police in the US were founded from slave catchers, and knowing that numerous reports highlight white extremism within the police, the problem still exists. Former President Barack Obama warned against the catchy slogan of defunding the police. But is it a catchy slogan? Black people continue to die at the hands of police, killed by the police in disproportionately higher numbers. Some have suggested that black people in the US are now being killed at the hands of the state faster than at the worst point in the history of racist Jim Crow laws. No one is saying all the police are racist, but when all the racists within the police seem to escape justice again and again, there's a battle for America's soul right now, and it's because of a history and a racist system which has never been accounted for.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Well, in this segment, a report by the French newspaper Le Monde last week on collaboration between Israel and their new Arab ally, the UAE, to eliminate UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. But has the Palestinian refugee problem been resolved? Well, no. Robert Inlakesh joins me now to make sense of it all for us. And Robert, can they legally and technically terminate UNRWA, considering its mandate has already been extended until 2023?
Well, at this point, it's unlikely that they're going to completely terminate it at this point. But if it's basically ruled null and void because of a lack of funding, which is essentially what's happening now, UNRWA will not be able to carry out its missions in the occupied territories, as well as in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Syria, etc. And of course, UNRWA provides aid for 5 million Palestinian refugees. For instance, in the Gaza Strip, it's heavily dependent upon these programs, civil society programs, food aid, etc. And also depends upon, the population depends upon UNRWA for jobs. So this attempt by the United Arab Emirates and also Israel to destroy UNRWA after the funding from the United States has been taken away, the biggest funder of UNRWA in the past, in 2018 when they withdrew that, is showing that the United Arab Emirates is on board with destroying the Palestinian refugee issue. The reason why this body was set up after the ethnic cleansing of 1947 to 1949 of Palestine was to provide basically a vehicle for the Palestinians to be able to get themselves on their feet, and that right of return, which is enshrined in international law, UN Resolution 194, to be implemented. Israel doesn't want that, of course. It wants the refugees to remain outside of Palestine. And the United Arab Emirates seems to be getting on board with destroying the Palestinian refugee issue. If that happens, what we will see is armed resistance go up and up against the Israelis, because that is the only thing left. International law has failed the Palestinian people, and armed groups are going to be the only option left. This is going to lead to more war and more violence.
It sure will, Robert. There's also this other aspect to it, the fact that UNRWA employs thousands of people, the majority of them Palestinian, and so their jobs also at risk if that were to happen. The UAE also a donor to the agency. That probably goes against what they have been doing all these years. How has the online world reacted to this story?
Well, people are extremely angry at this, and the first one we got here, we pulled up, is from a Twitter user called Russell, who says, illegitimate puppet dictators only in power to guarantee flow of oil to colonial powers know their petroleum-based clock is ticking and so must follow orders to guarantee foreign military aid. Nascent democracy shows up. We've got another one here commenting on this who says, disgusting behavior on the part of the UAE, traitors to the Palestinian people and to the Middle East.
All right, Rob, let's move on to your second story. Another Israeli strike, one of hundreds since the start of the 2011 civil war, on targets inside Syria. Tell us what we know.
Well, it's Israel's way of saying Merry Christmas to the Syrian people. This is the third consecutive year that Israel has struck Syria on Christmas Day. These attacks took place to the west of Hama in a place called Al-Masya. They used Lebanese airspace. This terrified people in Beirut who heard the war jets over the top of them. So they violated the sovereignty of Lebanon and then, of course, committed an act of war against Syria. These strikes, which have been carried out this year, not a single one of them has been responded to, and there has been zero provocations for these attacks. On top of that, what you're seeing on screen here is the strikes that were committed the following morning against the Gaza Strip, which struck a mosque, a school, disability rehab facility, sports facilities, civilian homes, and a children's hospital, and also destroyed power lines as well. So that hundreds of families now are without power altogether in the Gaza Strip. So this is what Israel has been doing over the Christmas holidays to the Palestinians on top of that, and to the Syrians and to the Lebanese. And on top of that as well, what we saw is that Israel denied permits for Palestinian Christians inside of Gaza and also the West Bank to go to Jerusalem because they wanted to, of course. And when it comes to the Gazans, they weren't allowed to go to Bethlehem or Jerusalem for the Christmas holidays.
And Robert, all of this happening at a time when Western nations in particular have remained silent. They haven't not a word out of these governments around the world.
Absolutely not. And this is, again, feeding into what I said before. If the United Nations, the international community fails, if international law is not upheld, the United Nations Security Council resolutions and UN General Assembly resolutions are not followed, what will happen is the people of the region, Israel's opposition in the region, that means states, and also organizations will take matters into their own hands because they have to. They're forced to at this point. International law has not worked. They must fight with armed resistance.
Well, I think now is the time to have a look at some of the online reaction to this.
The first one we've got here says, why is the UN, EU, NATO continually allowing Israel to commit their atrocities? Have they all been corrupted and bought and paid for? ? And we've got another one here as well from Sarah Abdullah who says, Israel has bombed Syria on Christmas nearly every year for the last several years. It's like a tradition, and of course, not even a single word of international outrage to speak of.
More on the timing of it all, Robert. You've already discussed that a little bit, but the fact that it's happening during this festive period, one of the reasons perhaps these governments, people in the Western world really celebrating Christmas and in a few days the New Year, and probably not paying attention to Israel's atrocities against Palestinians, against people in Syria.
Absolutely. It's a slap in the face, and basically it's Israel asserting once again that it can get away with whatever it wants. The aggression against Iran that we've seen this year, the aggression against Syria we've seen this year, the aggression we've seen against Lebanon this year in the West Bank with the massive home demolition campaign ongoing today. Tens of people have just been made homeless today as we're speaking. Journalists shot today as we're speaking. And on top of that as well, these bombardments which continue in the Gaza Strip. So, of course, Israel is just basically sticking its middle finger up to the international community and asserting that it can get away with anything at once and the law does not apply to it.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there now. Robert and Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast, everyone.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him
Why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something